Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to New Books in Political Science, a podcast on the New Books Network. I'm Susan Liebel at St. Joseph's University, and today I'm joined by Dr. Gordon H. Chang to discuss his book, Ghosts of Gold Mountain, the epic story of the Chinese who built the Transcontinental Railroad, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt Press in 2019. The book won the Asian Pacific American Librarians Award for Literature and the Chinese American Librarians Association Best Book Award. Ghosts of Gold Mountain recovers the history of how thousands of immigrants from southern China came to work on the Transcontinental Railroad, at the time an essential American infrastructure and the second largest construction project in the world after the Suez Canal. Despite their contribution, Chinese workers were marginalized politically, socially, and economically in their time and in subsequent treatments of American labor and immigration history. In Ghosts of Gold Mountain, Dr. Chang seeks to present a full account of the thousands who worked on the transcontinental history and their story as lived experience. In his words, quote, "The Chinese are presented not as voiceless objects of interest or docile human tools, but as vital, living, and feeling human beings who made history," unquote. American history, particularly our understanding of labor, immigration, and racism, is incomplete without focusing on the railroad Chinese. Dr. Gordon H. Chang is the Olive H. Palmer Professor in Humanities and Professor of History at Stanford University. He serves as Senior Associate Vice Provost for Undergraduate Education and co-directs the Chinese Railroad Workers in North America Project at Stanford. Among his scholarly works, Dr. Chang is the author of Fateful Ties, A History of America's Preoccupation with China from Harvard University Press, 2015, and co-editor of The Chinese and the Iron Road, Building the Transcontinental Railroad from Stanford University Press, 2019, with Shelley Fisher Fishkin. Dr. Chang writes at the intersection of U.S. diplomacy, America-China relations, the Chinese diaspora, Asian American history and global history, and it is my privilege to welcome him to the New Books Network. Welcome, Gordon.
Thank you, Susan. It's a delight to be here. I'm lovely occasions to be able to talk about my passion, which is this book and the work I did to produce it.
Well, I loved this book. It's one of the best books I've read in years. And I'll say more about that later. But I read a lot of books, and this was remarkable in all ways. Okay, since the history of the Chinese contribution to the building of the railroad has been obscured, let's start with some context for our listeners. The book opens with a photograph that some may have seen, taken by Andrew J. Russell in 1869. It's called East and West Shaking Hands, and it shows two steam engines representing the Central Pacific Railroad Company that started in Sacramento, California, and the Central and the Union Pacific that had started in Omaha, Nebraska. And they meet at Promontory Summit in Utah. So can you tell us a little bit about what's shown in the photo and also what is missing?
Well, I'd love to talk about the photo, and I do begin the book with it because it serves as something literal and also figurative. And as a historian, historians like to play with those dimensions. it's literal in the sense that that photo showing two great massive train engines meeting face to face or head to head, and engineers reaching across and shaking each other's hands and toasting and celebrating, and other folks gathered, almost all, I think they're all men, gathered in front of the engines and enjoying the celebratory moment. And it is perhaps the most famous, I think, photo from the 19th, certainly the mid or mid part of the 19th century. Maybe there's a photo of Abraham Lincoln that's more well known, but this one I think is very well known to most of the American public. And it is presented as often presented. Russell did not mean it when he took the photo, but it has come to symbolize the importance of the Transcontinental Railroad, is that it connected the East, the U.S. East and the far West, which had been divided by geography. And it also symbolized the reunion of the country with the Civil War recently passed. So it is a celebratory, it is presented as a celebratory moment of grand union, of manifest destiny, and of and great engineering and construction accomplishment. And it is often presented as I said, a nationalist moment. This is a great American moment. But left out of this photo, as many Chinese Americans believe, is any reference to of Chinese workers who comprise 90% of the construction workforce on the western portion of the railroad line, which was on the Central Pacific line. And they appear to be nowhere in the photo. So some Chinese Americans and other critics say this is a misleading photo. They were deliberately excluded from the photo. This was a literal erasure from the celebratory moment. I understand the sentiment, but there's no evidence that they were physically or deliberately excluded from the photo. In fact, other photos taken by A.J. Russell that day showed Chinese in great in presence, and including another photo, which should be more important, which is called Chinese Laying the Last Rail, which really shows Chinese railroad crews laying the last rail before the celebration presided by Leland Stanford. So it is taken as an example of grievance, for why there should be grievance about how the history has been told. Now, the metaphoric portion of the photo is that though it is believed that there was no Chinese in the photo, in fact, we discovered there is. My wife actually, I think, discovered it. We were up at the California State Railroad Museum, and they had this large enlargement of it, and we could see a lot of detail, which was obscured or invisible to those in just looking at it online or in a book. And right in the front of the photo, there's a figure who's quite fuzzy because apparently he's moving, and it has his back to the photographer. All the other people are looking at the camera and they can see their faces. But this fellow, you can't see his face. But from his body type and his clothes, I'm positive that this was a Chinese railroad worker, even perhaps for the crew. So his clothes are tattered. He's stooped over. He's moving. He's working. So in fact, the Chinese are in the frame. They are in the picture. But we've never seen him before. You know, so as I started off the book with that.
You know, as I read the book, I felt like the photographers, Alfred Hart, Carlton Watkins, Charles Savage, and the illustrator, also Joseph Becker, I thought they were characters in the book or like forms of research assistants, because they had either on purpose focused their lens on the Chinese workers or inadvertently captured the environment in which what you term the railroad Chinese were doing. And you mentioned the magnifying glass. I don't think you mentioned the story about the giant, the enlargement, but you mentioned a magnifying glass, and you'd really draw the reader to notice these tiny little details that would normally have escaped at least me, or the blurry image that turns out to be another character. Where were these photographs? You know, are they widely, excuse my ignorance, it's not my field, but are they widely known to scholars? And when did you first encounter them?
Most of these photos are available right online. And many had been viewed. They were not rare photos by and large. Alfred Hart took photos for the Central Pacific, and other photos were taken by other photographers, hired by other railroad lines. So they were company photographers. They were not ethnographers. They're not scholars. They were not art photo photographers per se. They've always been, many of these photos have been in the public realm, or at least available, even online. And that's how we got to know some of them. Alfred Hart photos, you can go to the Stanford University Library, you can see the digitization of them. The Russell photos are at the Oakland Museum. So they're not that rare or obscure, but we just didn't look at them and say, we historians, we scholars, we interested folks, never really looked at them with that much care or with the ability. And I do mention digitization, which I wanted to salute, that the digital world has enabled us historians and researchers to do things that were very difficult, if not impossible, for us to do before. Now, I make use of the photos because one of the great challenges to writing the book is that there is a dearth of sources. And as you said in your very nice introduction, I've tried to present the history of the Chinese rail workers from their point of view, from their lived experience, how they lived working on the Transcontinental Railroad line, not as just objects that other historians have written about in the railroad. The railroad construction is one of the great popular topics in American publishing. But it's very difficult to talk about the everyday experience of living people from their vantage point. We can talk about, and many people do, talk about the railroad from the vantage point of Leland Stanford or the Union Pacific people, the other robber barons and so forth, because they left voluminous records and diaries and correspondence. And so you can reconstruct their lives almost, you know, day by day, hour by hour, but not so workers, Chinese workers, Irish workers, Mormon workers, whoever. You know, the workers, unfortunately, in our history are often given short shrift. People just don't think of they're just sort of there. They've done the work.
I loved how you were able to make Stanford into their boss. So it's as if everything in the book is refocused from their point of view. He just becomes their employer rather than him and his diaries and his motivations becoming central. Though you tell his story because it's important to how they work. I really liked that. I appreciated the amount of work that it took to shift our gaze so that we got into their shoes. Before we get to your evidence, which is amazing where you're pulling all of this from, how did you get interested in the subject of the Transcontinental Railroad and the work of the Chinese? And is it awkward doing that at Stanford, where it's the money from the railroad owner that exploited the workers?
Well, the irony of it certainly didn't miss me. From the very beginning, we knew this could be a sensitive topic. But when we started our project, we needed money because we had ambitions to make it a big project, and we went to the administration, and they very generously and very quickly gave us great seed money. So I very much appreciate them, and they understood the value and the importance of history. And every effort to try to recover it as best we can. Now, as to how I got to the topic, I'm fourth generation Californian or U.S. My ancestors, I can first determine, came to the United States, landed in the United States in the early 1850s. So I've always appreciated my own family history as part of California and the history of the West. And even though I've always been historically inclined, I've had little opportunity to do very much sustained research certainly on the Chinese railroad workers, more recent history I've done. But finally, I have been able to do that. And so it was a topic that had long been in my mind when I first started graduate school in the 70s at Stanford. I came to get a PhD in Chinese history then. One of the first things I did was to go to the library and then went up to the special collections. So they were the Leland Stanford papers. I want to find out about Chinese railroad workers because they'd always been on my mind, but never knew very much about it. And they said, well, we don't have very much. And they didn't. So to this day, you can't find very much about the railroad workers from Leland Stanford's papers, the vast portion of which were destroyed by Jane Stanford, his wife, after he passed away, because there was presumably too much sensitive stuff.
Oh my
goodness.
And
so the personal archive is actually quite small, although there is still that much remains and other materials. So this was a personal project of mine for many years, but then there was the immediate timing. 2015, we started the project in 2012. 2015 was the 150th anniversary of the introduction of large numbers of Chinese onto the line. So we thought, oh, 3 years, 4 years, we'll, you know, we can come up with something in 2015 for that, those events that were planned. And then that went by very fast. But then 2019 was looming, and that was really a great moment to recognize. And that was the 150th anniversary of Promontory Summit, the moment that you mentioned in May 10th, 1869, when that epic photo is taken where the two lines come together and the ceremony completing, officially ending construction occurs. So we did that work in that time.
So you've been a scholar for a long time, but this is your first trade book. And I'm wondering what led you to write for a different audience. You simultaneously published the academic version, the Chinese Railroad Workers, Chinese in the Iron Road. Thank you very much. So why trade? What were you hoping to accomplish by writing to that wider audience?
The project had always been very collaborative because we knew from the beginning that this challenge of recovering their history was daunting. And we needed the resources and intelligence of many different people, I've been thinking about this for years, as I said, and I knew there was just a dearth of research material. So we'd have to think about new methodologies of historical recovery, possibly locating new resources. We thought about the importance of possibly locating material in China. We thought about other disciplines such as cultural studies, anthropology and archaeology, visual studies, and so it was a marvelous experience to collaborate with scholars from many different fields, some right at Stanford, religious studies, archaeology, cultural studies, literary studies, but all across the United States and in Canada and in Europe and in Asia, in Taiwan and mainland China and in Hong Kong. And we were able to pull together what we did because we all worked together and we all had little bits and pieces of the puzzle. So being comfortable with academic publishing, I knew, well, what we could do is people could then take a portion of it and write about it from their expertise and the discoveries that they found. And which they did. And we put together the big volume in Chinese on the Iron Road, which is 21 different essays by scholars who writing largely to other scholars or those who are somewhat familiar with the topic. But as this volume was coming together, it was pretty clear to me and to others in the project that there was no one really putting the whole story together. That we had 21 and more. We had many more essays than 21, and others of which have been published online in our website. Great work and continues to be done. But we needed someone to pull it all together, and there really wasn't anybody else. And so I said, I'll do it. And it had not been on my research agenda, but it was a great, wonderful experience to work with this material, research material that people had put together, and to put out something deliberately for an audience beyond specialists. And so that's how Ghosts of Golden Mountain comes about. And I decided, you know, it should be directed towards a broad audience.
It's beautifully written. It's a page turner. I read a lot of serious nonfiction, you know, in addition to reading all the political science and history and philosophy that I have to read for my scholarship. And sometimes books like this are a bit insulting to the reader. They repeat things over and over again. They pull people along a very clear path that I find tedious. What I thought was very interesting about this book was how, you know, you're dealing with a lot of places, a lot of names, a lot of equipment that is not familiar to the reader. It all becomes very familiar. But you set things up so that we notice a problem, and then a few pages later, you solve it for us. And I really appreciated that part of it. I think this is a very serious book, but also a clearly written, lively, colorful book in which you sort of feel like you can see it. It's really beautifully written.
I appreciate your observation comments so much, Susan. That's very touching. And you know, I've heard similar comments from many others, and it's been very rewarding. And it's, these comments have made it all worthwhile, because you know, writing for an academic audience is one thing. I mean, trying to reach others, whatever background, is a different challenge. And then third, well, the other challenge too is I'm a professional historian. I've been academic most of my professional life. And so I write in a certain way, or I think in a certain way, present it. And I had to sort of shift. But and I also had certain standards and requirements. So I didn't want to do quote unquote makeup history, or, you know, didn't write fiction as much as I respect fiction, but the book, I hope, is really well grounded, and everything that's in there is something I've tried to document. So that goes back to the challenge again of how to write about something like this when we have a thin resource base, particularly from the Chinese themselves. As I said in the book, we still to this day do not have a single document from a Chinese railroad worker, not a memoir, oral history, diary, letter, scrap of correspondence, not a single bit of information in their own hand or word.
Well, you get around it by using every possible form of evidence. You have business records, you have archaeological remains from the work sites, you have letters, genealogical documents, press reports, poetry, folk songs. You trace down the diets of what would have been brought to the workers, or what they themselves would have taken from the environments that they were in, to try to replace that direct first person, you know, gold standard, the thing that all historians hope to find. And I think you do a good job of capturing, you know, what they saw and where they were. And you really do center the story on them. And you say that you're trying to see the world from their point of view. And I think that gets accomplished. Can you just share a tiny bit about that research? I know you've already mentioned a little bit about how much coordination it involved. I don't know, some aha moments in an archive or a discipline that you didn't expect would play such a role in excavating this history.
One of the first things I had to do when I began writing was to reposition myself. I mean, all writers, we write from a position. There's positionality. And academic historians usually adopt dispassionate, detached, elevated position. And I could not do that because it just would not do justice to the objective that I wanted to achieve. So I had to really think, and I would go to bed literally all night to try to place myself in the worker's position, what they were doing at night, what they were doing at day, what they're doing their time off. And that juxtaposition, that shift was so fundamental and so important. And therefore, I would look at all the evidence again, not to, because almost all the evidence, like a photograph, it takes the photos of the Chinese as objects. They're standing there. You can see them far distant. But what if I turn that around and I put myself in their position, looking at the photographer? What would they see? What was their environment? So the photographers were not interested in capturing their lived experience. But all around them, they captured the consequences of their work, the results of their labor. You can see the cut trees. You can see the roadbed. You can see all the soil and rock that's been excavated and dumped and constructed. And therefore, as soon as one does that, then one thinks, well, people did that. It just didn't happen. A bulldozer didn't happen. It was rock, picks and shovels and carts, human muscle that did all this. And then I would see a photo of a labor camp. And I use digital technology. And if you look at online, you can just see basically the tents. But if you can enlarge it through digitization, you can see people walking around. You can see the Chinese workers walking around. You can see their laundry. You can see them sitting around eating. And that just humanized them. So then that led to all sorts of questions about how they did it. You know, what were they wearing? What were they eating? How did they get their food? And then I would read evidence such as one of the engineers, a white engineer who was head of the mining operations and part of the construction effort, wrote a very beautiful letter or memoir about his experience. One night walking in the work, went out at night in the High Sierra. Snow had fallen. It was quiet when he went out. And it was just a gorgeous, he wrote very beautifully. And he talked about walking under the trees with the heavy with the snow. And were weighed down, and he looked up in the sky, and he could see the stars in the sky. And then he could hear and see the tunnels, the entries to the tunnels lit up with the lanterns for the Chinese railroad workers. And he could hear the boom, boom, boom. And he was almost poetic, and he said that those were stars that had come down into the mountains. That was marvelous. So I really appreciated, you know, that observation. But then again, twist that around. Those were workers here in the darkness of night, in these dark caverns with lanterns and working with black powder to make cracks into the granite. So that's the approach that I took.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Well, whatever you discomfort you were feeling lying awake trying to figure this out, you actually pass on to the reader, because that discomfort with their environment was something I felt I was experiencing. Obviously, I've not been a 19th century railroad worker, but I felt cold as you were describing the amount of snow and how they were moving it and how are they trying to keep it off of the railroad, let alone themselves. The description of the food preparation is remarkably visual, even though it's a book. This needs to be a documentary. It'd be really great documentary. And I really liked how the book sort of sets the record straight on these different levels. So on the micro level, you're trying to settle whether or not Chinese workers were lowered down this mountain face in a basket. You know, is that true? Is that a myth, or did that really happen? But also on the macro level, because you're also trying to show that the Chinese workers as founding people, you know, people who made America figuratively and literally and had their contribution erased. And I thought the way you used what you had, and you did have, I think his name is Hui Kin. The he's not a railroad worker, but he's writing at the same time. I thought the way you used his eyes getting off the boat, getting into San Francisco was really a terrific way of giving us a Chinese voice, even though we didn't have a Chinese railroad worker's voice. Let's just talk a little bit about their names and why we don't have their names. And where these workers came from. So, where did they come from, and why did they come from southern China to the American West?
Well, you mentioned the baskets. Maybe we should not leave them hanging. But this is a moment which is very controversial, and I do address historical controversies in the book. The book is narrative, but I do embed in the narrative my effort to address these serious controversies, and one of them was whether or not Chinese workers got into woven wicker baskets, a wicker or some woven with something, and brought over the side of a cliff and lowered down to work on the surf, rock face of this place, which is still called Cape Horn, because it's a large promontory that blocks the route of the railroad line. And the only way it had to get around it, but it was so steep and then dangerous that you couldn't construct the railroad line as one did on a more level surface. So the story went that they would use these baskets, and you could just try to imagine that these men in a basket, or two men in a basket, hung down the side of a mountain and using chisels and banging away and trying to make holes for the black powder or whatever to make a foothold for the line. And this became quite a issue of contention. And there were those who for years had insisted that this had happened. And I wanted to believe it happened because it was such a dramatic and powerful story. But just as emotionally or strongly, there were those who emerged as opponents of this. And I'd have to say, I did not like their interpretation at first, because I think they were also prejudiced. They said this was just sort of victim history. There was no evidence for this, but they had they made an argument, and they excavated the material and said that, look, this doesn't sustain this account. So I was challenged. So what am I going to? I went in thinking yes, then I just said, well, maybe no, and then I really did the work, and from what we were able to put together, I became convinced that yes, it did happen. And the evidence is compelling, and I think completely credible. It may not have happened at a particular location, but the basket story is real.
And that's a section of the book where I felt like you respected the reader. You laid out that controversy. You made me feel like, oh, maybe this isn't actually true. This was something families told about, and it was heroic. And then you use the newspaper reports, you use these eyewitness reports of the tourists who take the train out and speak of the men in the baskets. And so it's another one of those examples of really respecting the reader's ability to deal with historical controversy and understand, in a sense, you make the craft very transparent in that moment in the book of how history is done. One group says X, another group says Y. How would we get at it? And I loved that part of the book. So,
And the other bit of evidence, I use a variety of different methods, and one was to respect engineering, physical engineering, and that was one of the arguments used by the opponents of the view that said, look, there's the percentage of the grade and the type of soil was this or that, and therefore discounted the possibility or the utility of using baskets. But then I went and found other evidence from the time that disputed their contention. So yes, we had to bring in a little bit of engineering science into the story.
Now it's an interdisciplinary work for sure. Okay, let's see. Why did all of the Chinese come to work on the railroads? What were they hoping to find in the Western United States? And what was the motivation of the companies for trying to bring them to California?
The formal project of the what we would call the Transcontinental Railroad, it doesn't begin until 1862. After Abraham Lincoln, President Lincoln, signs a bill to authorize federal support for this massive effort. And the Central Pacific Railroad, headed by Leland Sanford and others, who became known as the Big Four, all legendary people in California history, but also national history, and Collis Huntington and you folks out on the East Coast, the Huntington name is might be familiar to those, particularly around the New York area. Became all very, very wealthy. Charles Crocker and Mark Hopkins and Stanford. They started the Central Pacific Railroad. They were all wealthy men to begin with, but also had their own prejudices. And when they started the line, they explicitly said that they would hire only white workers. And they did not hire Chinese from the beginning. But there was a real lack of labor supply in California. Workers couldn't come out from the East Coast easily to get to the Central Pacific. It took 6 to 8 weeks to go from New York to San Francisco before the Transcontinental Railroad. They had to take a vessel from New York to Panama, walk across Panama, and then come up on the other side, or go all the way down the tip of South America and come all the way back up, all very, very dangerous sea routes and difficult and disease and so forth, or take a train out to Nebraska and then get off and basically walk the rest of the way through unsettled territory, conquered territory for this native country. And so that took 6 to 8 weeks, and a lot of people died. So that's why the Central Pacific had a labor supply problem. Then finally, in late 1864, they were not making the progress. They just didn't have the thousands of workers that they needed. You needed not just 100, it's 200 or 500. You needed 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, 5,000, 10,000 workers. And so finally, they turned to hiring Chinese who had been in the States, such as my ancestors, for 15-something years, a number of them. And they had worked in infrastructure, building roads and bridges and vineyards and all this. So they had done heavy work previously. And so they began to introduce some of these workers onto the railroad in work teams. And they worked out so marvelously that they hired more and more. A sidelight on the story is that we're not sure where or how the idea of hiring Chinese originated. And one story, which I think is credible, although we'll never be able to definitively answer this, it seemed it might have come from Chinese themselves, that it is said from a descendant of one of the big four who I interviewed, and they said within the family, there was the story that the manservant of one of the big four had mentioned to the fellow, why not hire Chinese? Because he'd heard, you know, he was in the inner sanctum, heard all these problems.
Right.
And so the idea of using Chinese may have come from a Chinese guy himself. So they began to hire a handful, then 50, 100, several hundred, and then there was just not enough already. So then they began in 1865 to send agents and fly handbills. They actually printed handbills in California and sent them to China to distribute, to recruit right from China. And so a stream of workers begins to come from southern China to California. So the Chinese who worked on the line were both those who had been here in California for some time, and then also who were newcomers who came right over directly from China to work on this project, which had already become mythical in many respects, of this railroad line that stretched across the continent. And that's how the number of workers eventually reaches up to, it's estimated by the big four themselves, or Leland Stanford, up to 12,000 at any one moment. But because there was turnover, and I think this is an important issue, because they were able to come and go, or they did come and go. They were not indentured onto the line, but they would sometimes leave because the work was too dangerous, hard, and they'd get better pay somewhere else. So getting these wages from the railroad company or from other employers was the big attraction for these fellows who were largely young men, late teens, into their 20s, prime working age, and they'd come over. They were released from their family farms to come over and labor. So overall, we estimate maybe 20,000 worked for some time on the railroad line up until 1869. And then afterwards, well, this is the other part of the story, which is really even less well known, is that many Chinese continue to work on railroad lines throughout the United States, on the transcontinental itself, and maintaining and rebuilding portions of it, but also they traveled now on the rail line back to the throughout the South, Midwest, Southwest, and built rail lines throughout much of the rest of the United States, in Tennessee, and Arkansas, and Arizona, Massachusetts, and Long Island. And we learned this, again, paying tribute to the digital world, is there are enormous research resources online now, and particularly American newspapers, regional, local newspapers that have been digitized. And those sources had been available before, but historians just didn't have the means and ability and time to go to all these little local archives and libraries to search for the small town newspapers. But now we can just search for them, and found scores, hundreds of mentions of Chinese railroad workers as they entered these towns. They were clearly spectacles to the local press, and they took note of it, and they wrote about them. So this is how we were able to compile that part of the story by using even the journalism at the time.
I have students using Chronicling America, and they marvel at what they can find, you know, just because there's now a search tool. It's an amazing resource. When you talk about Stanford and some of the executives, you actually sort of say that they had a bit of an arc, that Stanford himself sort of started at the beginning thinking of the Chinese as, quote, you know, degraded and distinct people. And by the end, he has a very, very different view of them. I wonder if you could just say a little bit about that, about the perception and the way that Chinese labor changes the perception of these railroad barons.
Well, to use a term we would use today, the Chinese pay their dues. And by paying their dues, they were able to advance. But to be more specific, you know, Leland Stanford, and again, this is where I went in thinking one way and came out thinking another way, as historians should. Even as scholars go, you go and look at the evidence and you make up your mind after looking at the evidence. But we go in with a certain assumption, and that was, mine was, Leland Stanford was a sort of pretty kind of a robber baron, a racist dog, because I knew about his inaugural address as the first Republican governor of California, and he was spoke to the California legislature in 1861. He'd been had attended, I think, Abraham Lincoln's inauguration. So he was a prominent Republican and businessman in California, but he was also very prejudiced. And he gave a short address. And the main item on his address was how to keep the Chinese out of California. And he said, you quoted him correctly, and he said that the Chinese would repel the superior race from populating his state. And so he didn't want that. And so he called on the legislature to try to find ways to have a state exclusion method. So that was very well known. It's been very well publicized. But over time, particularly after the railroad construction, his tone changed remarkably, but that change in tone is not as well known. And I have an essay in the book Chinese and the Iron Road, where I focus on the Stanfords, Jane and Leland, and their relationship with the Chinese over their long lives, and how they've changed, how they were quietly, sometimes quite prejudiced. He was a politician and spoke to a public press, but other times very, very close, including, incredibly, sometime in the 1850s, I believe it was, if I recall now, where they were very saddened that they hadn't had children. And eventually they did. They had Leland Jr., and Leland Jr. was the love of their life, and he died tragically contracting cholera or something in Europe. So that's why we have Leland Stanford Jr. University, which is named for him. But before he came along, Jane wanted to adopt a Chinese houseboy who was in their employ in Sacramento. And it was incredible. Now, that didn't work out in part because the Chinese boy and his older brother objected.
I love that part of the book.
The older brother said, you can't be adopted because we're not orphans.
Right, we have parents.
We have parents. And there's a racial question and this. And both of them became quite successful, and he, to his dying day, had the greatest praise and affection for the Stanfords, because of how they treated him and supported his eventual business efforts and all this. And he had memorabilia from the family, including engraved items. So it is a story of, as all human stories, of change. People do change over time. And Stanford really is an example of that.
One of the interesting themes in the book is language. On the one hand, the Chinese are treated as a racialized other, and some of their treatment is inhumane. There's a remarkable amount of violence in this book. The workers are paid less. They have to live in different quarters than other workers. They're also superhuman. So they're sort of also described as these sort of remarkably resolved, efficient, systematic, disciplined. They're better, neater, cleaner, that's a quote, faster and cheaper than white workers. You know, they're precise. And one of the problems I actually had reading the book was how to sort through the extent to which some of this was overcoming prejudice in their recognition of the talents and the organization of the Chinese workers. And on the other hand, a kind of language that is suspect because it's the result of racist expectations, either that they won't be these things or also that they're some sort of machines. And I wondered how you dealt with that language as you were working through the writing of the book.
Well, that's a great point. The language is important. And the description of the Chinese in those terms is repeated in a number of different articles and essays, and observers make the same thing. They remark on the, if you will, the work ethic and the efficiency and the economy of the workers. And Leland Stanford and others talked about this too. So this sort of picture is shared by many different observers. They don't get drunk. They don't go carouse. And there was always comparisons, as the capitalists would call them at the time, made comparisons to different worker group communities, Irish or African Americans or Mormons or Mexicans and Chinese, and they would make generalizations about their work styles and communities and habits and this, and then pit them against each other too, which we can talk about how they deliberately hired them to do certain tasks or during strikes to break strikes. But I think that this characterization of the Chinese is what it resulted in, really sort of a elevation of the Chinese. They had received mixed reception from the beginning when their entry in the country. Some had despised them. They hated them because they were for racial reasons and cultural reasons. But then others, quite from the beginning, also commented and had the same kind of attributes given to them, gave to them. And so part of it, I think, is that the Chinese did bring over a work ethic. And this is something I do a little bit on in China, how they did work, who they were. What their expectations were, and they were also very disciplined. They worked in gangs, and they also had labor contractors overseeing them. They were largely trying to raise money to send back to their families. So there were incentives for them to be work hard, and the wages they got, even though they were significantly lower than white workers, were enormously higher than what they could get in China. So they would accept this wage differential. The other characteristic that was put upon them was and this word was used often, was docile. That even they did all these things, and they were cheaper, and they were docile. They docile meaning that they really didn't protest much, or they didn't resist the supervisors and this. Now, I don't think that meant that docile in the sense they were just sort of passive, because obviously they were working very hard, but they weren't resistant as some of the other working groups were with resisting the supervision and tasks. Now, interestingly, you raise this up because I was on a conversation with an academic group, a university group, mainly students, but also some faculty. And one of the faculty members raised the same observation you just did. And he said, you know, it really reminded him of some of our contemporary characterization of Asian Americans or Chinese Americans. Worked so efficiently. You can't compete against them. They work so hard. And they also don't protest. They're sort of a model. And I think that observation, you can find this with these words in the newspapers and so forth of the time, that are eerily present, speak to the present. So, yes, there are certain community characteristics, but also observations. We can talk about what this history means for the present moment, but part of it, I think it does open a way of thinking about how at least the Chinese community has been racialized and characterized over time, as there is a persistent view of that the Chinese are both, as I said, offensive and inoffensive. They're offensive because COVID and they were different, they weren't Christian and all that, so they're offensive. But they're inoffensive too, because they were docile. They didn't fight back, which was not true because, as I talk about in the book, they went on strikes. They did resist their super exploitation. But today, there's the same thing. I think there's so much of this anti-Asian violence I see as coming from this same sense of Asians are offensive, but they're also inoffensive, and therefore you can pick on them. You can just assault them right on the street, as Chinese had been in California in the 1860s and 1870s.
And I want to talk about this notion of what is the connection between this book and our present. The docility part, as I was reading it, and you make this point, so I'm not making it, I'm just pulling it out of the book, is also deeply gendered. Because this association of whether or not the Chinese are manly comes into play throughout the book, and sometimes it seemed to me to be, on the one hand, that the Chinese are the perfect Americans. They're hardworking. They pull up their bootstraps and they are willing to sweat and blow things up and do all of the sort of conquering of nature. But on the other hand, they are deprived of a certain notion of masculinity that is normally accorded to the male worker in the United States. And I saw you playing with that as well in the book.
Well, I saw that discussion played out at the time, that observers played with that, is that you're right in how repeat these words, but I think at the time it sort of was a challenge to observers that the Chinese were so different. They could be model citizens, and there were newspaper articles that were quite celebratory, particularly after 1869. So this was the coming man, was the title of this series repeatedly, the coming man, and I just said, that's such an interesting language. Why do you use this in the title, The Coming Man? And it would talk up, the articles would talk about them in more sort of masculine ways, but others would talk them in more feminized ways. And some of the articles didn't acknowledge that they were very different because they didn't bring their women folk over, or at least in very large numbers, and were not establishing permanent family communities, which was a problem. But some of them, so shockingly, even said, well, they'll just intermarry. Intermarry with whites, with blacks, with natives, or, you know, some of them. And they were envisioned as becoming a permanent part of the American family. It was quite striking to read these, because that was not part of the usual narrative that we hear about with the 1882 Exclusion Act, which we can talk about. But this is, I said, there was this moment in the 1870s, which corresponded with the era of Reconstruction, so I put in a national context of an openness about race and connection that lived for a while and then closed up.
At the end of the introduction, you say that this is a story of ghosts, past, but also in the present, and ghosts that resonate with the living. And you mentioned the present, and you know, we see this drastic increase in violence against Asian Americans. We have the recent mass shooting in Atlanta, in which 6 of the 8 victims were Asian women. And in the conversation that we've been having, we're focusing on this long and complex history of discrimination, but particularly about the Chinese Exclusion Acts starting in 1882 and the Page Act earlier in 1875, I think, that were aimed at denying Chinese in America citizenship, and you do an amazing job in the book of sort of placing the railroad history and drawing connections between the success of the Chinese in building the railroad and the Chinese Exclusion Acts that were to follow. So as you're looking at today, obviously you wrote this book went to press well before the shootings in Atlanta and maybe even some part of the last years of our politics, given how long it often takes things to get to press. Like, how do you see the connection between this history and our present and understanding uh, the the role of the Chinese in America today, or more widely Asian Americans?
Well, I think there are many connections that we can make between the past and the present. The one I would make here is related to what we began the conversation on, and that was the photo of the erasure of the seemingly the erasure of Chinese from the photo, from the historical past. And what is significant about that is, well, it's wrong, but it also does tremendous damage to everything that comes afterwards. And that is to say, it misinterprets, it mispresents the past and who we are. So with what we hear in the contemporary violence against Asian Americans is so often is the slur, and you know, all Asian Americans have heard this. I heard this. You know, go back to where you came from, or where are you really from? They say, well, I'm from California. No, where are you really? This kind of stuff. And so Asian Americans, no matter how long one is here and how long the communities live here, they're sort of taken by some sectors of society as just alien, as eternally foreign. Now, that's ignorance, it's prejudice, but it's also rooted in the in ignorance of the past. That is, this history of the railroad workers building one of the epic moments, projects of American history that transformed the United States, was the result of alien workers, foreign workers, Chinese workers. So they were an integral part of making America modern. But without that appreciation, or at least acknowledgement, then they will be seen as somehow not there, not contributing, somehow not part of the past, and therefore not part of the present or the future.
Now, the sort of permanent othering of the Chinese, the only parallel I can really think of it of is Latinx Americans who trace their ancestry to the 17th century or earlier, and yet they are permanently viewed as somehow, where are you from, as opposed to being accepted as part of the founding peoples of the United States. I loved this book, and I could just keep asking you question after question, but tell me if there's something I haven't asked you about that you really want to leave people with and will encourage everybody else to read the book.
Well, thank you, Susan. A great conversation we've had here, and I've appreciated your time. I'll leave you just with there's so many anecdotes which are telling. So why the title of the book? Why Ghosts of Gold Mountain? So again, I use the term as ghosts in different ways. Somewhat literally, in the sense of the time that the Chinese railroad workers really deeply believed in ghosts. I mean, many of us believe, obviously, in spirits or souls and ghosts today. But they really, their whole existence was structured around recognition of the past, of their past descendants. And one of the tragedies for a Chinese of that time was to die in a foreign land and not be able to receive a proper burial and have the remains returned to the ancestral home, where they would be there for these descendants to give their obeisance to and respect through eternity. But Chinese, when they died here, and hundreds, thousands died here, and many of them never were recovered because of explosions or landslides and all that. And so the story went also that they became ghosts. They became hungry ghosts. And they populated the California gold country and mountain country, it was said. And I remember growing up hearing stories said that if you go in different parts of the Sierra, at certain times of the night and seasons, you could hear the wailing of these Chinese ghosts. It's very eerie, you know, because they're still wandering and they're still suffering in this netherworld. Now, In May 18, 2019, I went out to Promontory Summit, Utah. This was after the book is published. And there was a great deal of celebration and commemoration of the 150th there. And there was a journalist spoke to a young girl, cowgirl, blonde cowgirl, local, and talked about the railroad in different ways. And they said, oh, by the way, any comment about the Chinese who worked around here? And she was local. And she said, yeah, you know, we know that when we go out to the plains up here in Utah, at certain times of the seasons and at night, we hear the wailing of Chinese ghosts. And I heard that story, and I was speechless. I almost fell over. It was said almost in the same way. So ghosts could be real.
I love the way the ghosts appear throughout the book in different ways, and I won't spoil any of that for readers. Gordon, what's your next project? What are you working on now?
Well, I'm thinking about resuming a project that is long stalled, about violence, and it speaks to the current moment, about racial violence post Pearl Harbor. What happened after December 7th against Asians, or people looked like the enemy, but were not what happened in that? So we sort of know there was a lot going on, but I've already done a lot of the research to look at the terrible incidents that happened, which has just been sort of ignored or covered up. But again, it's part of our need to confront these episodes in the past.
Well, thank you so much for coming on New Books to discuss Ghost of Gold Mountain, the epic story of the Chinese who built the Transcontinental Railroad. It's available from Houghton Mifflin Harcourt Press 2020. Gordon, do you have a favorite bookstore in your neighborhood that you would like to shout out for people to go buy the book there?
Sure. Well, the classic store here is Kepler's in Menlo Park.
Okay. All right. Find your Kepler's, buy it from a brick and mortar, and thank you all so much for listening, and thank you so much for joining me today.
It's been a pleasure, Susan. Thank you. Great conversation.